I say, every time I see people rise against authoritarianism, against police brutality, anywhere in the world, this gives me hope, because for me, this is a movement that has to happen all over the world.
That's Leila Swif, mathematics professor and mother of Alaa and Saneh. She was interviewed by Democracy Now! Correspondent Sharif Abdelkaddous in Cairo, Egypt. An online petition has been launched at change.org calling on Egypt's attorney general to release prisoners being held in pretrial detention and to allow Alaa Abdel Fattah and other prisoners to communicate with their families and for the release of Sanaa Seif. That does it for today's broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us. Wear a mask and...
KABU Community Radio and the Jazz Society of Oregon are thrilled to bring you the 40th annual Cathedral Park Jazz Festival, July 17th, 18th, and 19th, as a live streaming event. Tune in and you'll hear the area's finest jazz, blues, R&B, and Latin musicians over the course of 3 days. The Bayou Boys, Bobby Torres, Saida Wright, and Tezeta Band are just a few of the 15 bands performing this year. That's the 40th annual Cathedral Park Jazz Festival, streaming live and on KABU, Portland's longest-running community event, July 17th, 18th, and 19th. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage. I've been in the right place, but it must have been the wrong time.
I'd have said the right thing. James Chassie, a gentle soul who lived with schizophrenia, was well known in Portland as a writer, artist, and musician. In 2006, James was brutally killed by Portland police. He committed no crime, yet he was tackled, beat, kicked, and tased. He later died in police custody. The police officers who killed James Chassie were never held accountable. Join us on Prison Pipeline, July 6th at 6:30 p.m. as we remember James Chassie.
At KBOO, we think that all communities deserve to be fully informed on the policies and decisions that will impact their lives, and we need your help to make that happen. We're looking for citizen journalists to help collect, report, and broadcast the news. Do you think that there are groups that are underrepresented or marginalized by the mainstream media? Are you aware of social, political, or environmental activities that don't have adequate visibility? Are there important issues in your town or region that aren't getting coverage? This is your chance to give a voice to the voiceless. You don't have to have experience, and you don't have to come into KABU's Portland studio. You can contribute from wherever you live. If you have some basic writing skills and a desire to get the word out, we want you. Just send an email with your idea and contact information to newsdirector, that's all one word, newsdirector@kboo.fm, and include the words citizen journalist in the subject line, and the news team will contact you. Once again, send that email to newsdirector@kboo.fm.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, protests against police brutality and systemic racism continued over the weekend. Oregon surpasses 10,000 total confirmed and presumptive cases of COVID-19, and a federal judge rules that the Dakota Access Pipeline must be shut down. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, July 6th, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. Protests against police brutality and systemic racism continued over the weekend in Portland. Saturday, July 4th, marked the 36th consecutive night of large protests in Portland following the murder of George Floyd by police in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Saturday night saw an escalation in the amount of tear gas, or CS gas, that was indiscriminately used on protesters by law enforcement. This comes despite the passage of a new state law that limits when police can use tear gas, as well as several lawsuits restricting the use of the chemical weapons on nonviolent protesters. Saturday night's protests began in front of the Multnomah County Justice Center. By about 10 p.m., a crowd of around 500 demonstrators gathered in the joint park blocks facing the Justice Center and the Hatfield Federal Courthouse. Portland police declared the protest a riot just after 11 p.m. and began firing tear gas canisters. On June 30th, Governor Kate Brown signed a bill into law that prohibits the use of tear gas by law enforcement except after a riot is declared. In addition, the law does not apply to federal law enforcement officers. Several journalists also said they were told to leave the area even after displaying their press badges. By 2:30 a.m., only a small group of demonstrators remained, watching as federal officers in tan camouflage, bulletproof vests, and helmets blocked off the streets to the courthouse. Portland police again declared a riot at 4 a.m. and deployed crowd control weapons. On Sunday, the 39th consecutive day of protests, demonstrators again gathered outside the Multnomah County Justice Center in downtown Portland. A line of Portland police and U.S. Marshals separated the group of protesters from the building. At least 15 people were arrested over the weekend on various charges, including illegally carrying a firearm, reckless endangerment, disorderly conduct, and rioting. An Oregon state trooper was caught using the OK hand gesture during a Black Lives Matter protest in Salem this weekend. The gesture is used to represent white power in various neo-fascist communities. Footage of the rally was streamed live on social media and shows the officer approaching a group of counter-protesters where he makes the gesture as one of the counter-protesters pats him on the back. The Oregon State Police said the trooper used his hands because of the facial covering he was wearing and the noisy environment. Authorities maintain that the officer was checking on the status of a man who was allegedly shoved down by protesters and that the pats on the back were merely a sign of appreciation from crowdgoers. The protester who allegedly shoved the man is Christopher Davis, who police arrested on suspicion of disorderly conduct and harassment. Other participants at Saturday's rally have suggested that the counter-protesters the officer approached are affiliated with the far-right organization, the Proud Boys, which has been designated a hate group, and that communications between the group and armed militia were intent on disrupting the protest. Joe Smothers, who filmed the incident and was demonstrating in support of Black Lives Matter, noted in a post that members of the Proud Boys had been flashing the OK sign throughout the rally. Initial tweets of the video were published just before 10 p.m. Saturday night, and by early Sunday afternoon had amassed over 42,000 retweets. National news media has refused to air the video in efforts to avoid providing a platform to an apparent expression of hate or white supremacy. According to the Oregon State Police, as of Monday, the trooper has been cleared of charges, though an internal investigation remains ongoing. On Monday, the Oregon Health Authority reported 168 new cases of COVID-19 and 0 new deaths. Today's case total breaks a 4-day streak of over 300 new coronavirus cases being reported by officials in the state. As of Monday afternoon, there are 10,395 confirmed and presumptive cases of COVID-19 in Oregon. There have been 215 deaths in the state as Oregon now passes the 10,000 case mark. Nationally, the number of coronavirus cases in the U.S. continues to grow quickly. As of Monday afternoon, at least 2.9 million people across the country have tested positive for the virus. At least 130,000 patients with the virus have died. The Oregon Zoo announced plans for reopening on Monday after nearly 4 months of locked gates due to coronavirus health concerns. Starting July 9th, the zoo will reopen for members only through July 11th, with the general public being welcomed starting on July 12th. New safety measures have been established as part of the reopening in efforts to prohibit the spread of COVID-19 and ensure zoo-goers' safety. For all guests, including members, timed tickets must be reserved in advance online for entrance, as new guidelines will maintain a reduced capacity and staggered viewings. The zoo is requiring facial coverings for all entrants over the age of 5, with the exception of individuals unable to wear masks due to medical conditions. Once inside, guests will follow a one-way path through the zoo, with hand-washing stations and free hand sanitizer set up along the way and at the entrances of restrooms and eating areas. Some exhibits, primarily the indoor and high-touch areas, will remain closed for the time being, making the reopening a strictly outdoor experience. During the closure, Zoo Director Dr. Don Moore said donors provided $1 million to the Oregon Zoo Foundation's Emergency Recovery Fund, helping sustain essential zoo support services. Young people in New Mexico who are aging out of the state's juvenile justice system during the pandemic have found many offices closed, so it's harder to get the documents needed for a job or a driver's license. Roz Brown has more on the story with the Public News Service.
Like the prison population in general, minority youth are disproportionately represented in the U.S. juvenile justice system in nearly every state. But COVID-19 has brought some unforeseen changes. The Annie E. Casey Foundation says fewer young people are being admitted to jails during the health crisis, and the drop has been bigger for youth of color than their white peers. Ezra Spitzer with the New Mexico Child Advocacy Network says a decrease should serve as a reflection point about whether reform would allow more kids to safely return to their communities sooner than previously thought.
Even departments are saying, like, well, we've been reforming and these are the things we've done. And people are saying, yeah, that's not enough. And it's such an interesting time that it's occurred during this pandemic.
The Casey Foundation reports the total juvenile detention population dropped by about one-third between March 1st and May 1st. White youth detention fell 26%, while detention fell 30% for Black youth and 29% for Latino youth. Nett Bayless directs juvenile justice strategy for the Casey Foundation and speculates some of the lower incarceration rates may be because COVID-19 shut down the school-to-prison pipeline.
There are thousands and thousands of young people arrested every year in their schools. For the last 3 months, of course, there have been no young people in America who've been attending their schools. So we know that that cuts off an entire source of arrests.
The push to reform the juvenile justice system is ongoing. But Spitzer says an incremental or band-aid approach no longer works.
I think what the reformers are wanting is big. I think there's a new generation of advocates coming in, right, who are much less incremental than the previous ones. And I think it's shifting the conversation.
The New Mexico Children, Youth, and Families Department says the hardest thing for young people transitioning out of the state's juvenile justice system during the pandemic is finding a job. That's partly because of difficulty in obtaining an ID, birth certificate, or Social Security card. For Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
A 3.9 magnitude earthquake struck early Monday morning off the coast of Oregon, roughly 279 miles west of Bandon. The trembler hit at 4:48 a.m., according to the U.S. Geological Survey, and had a depth of about 6 miles. No damage or injury has been reported following the quake, with most residents not even feeling it due to the time of the morning. Scientists are not connecting Monday's quake with the larger earthquakes that rocked Mexico and California 2 weeks ago. This is the third quake to strike the area in 2020, with a 4.7 magnitude tremble striking roughly 140 miles west of Coos Bay back in early February. Funding through the Payroll Support Program and the CARES Act has helped keep hundreds of thousands of airline workers employed and covered under their health care plans during the coronavirus pandemic. Eric Galatis has more on the story with the Public News Service.
America's pilots, machinists, flight attendants, and other unions are calling on Congress to extend emergency relief designed to keep airline employees on the payroll with benefits. Dan Maurer with the Communications Workers of America says the payroll support program in the CARES Act is essential for keeping the nation's airline industry viable during and after the pandemic. He says if credentialed and experienced workers are laid off, airlines can't hire just anyone to take their place.
From the ground service agents to the flight attendants and the pilots. If you don't have those people who are trained, who have the proper background, who've gone through all the checks that they need, you're not going to be able to fly a plane safely.
Maurer says keeping credentialed workers is essential for consumer confidence as airlines resume full capacity operations because travelers will want to know it's safe to start flying again. Some lawmakers opposed to government intervention in the marketplace have been reluctant to advance new aid packages. Maurer says if hundreds of thousands of airline workers are laid off, the economic hit at major hubs, including Denver International Airport, would be felt throughout Colorado and would put additional stress on the state's unemployment and other safety net programs. He also believes government intervention is the right thing to do in this moment to protect an industry integral to the nation's economy.
The reality is the free market isn't built to deal with a global pandemic. Airlines cannot function profitably with only being, you know, a third or a half full.
The payroll support program is set to expire on September 30th this year. Aviation labor leaders are asking Congress to extend the program at least through March of 2021. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Galatas.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for a special broadcast of Making Contact, speaking with law professor Kimberly Crenshaw, who helped to define the concept of intersectionality 30 years ago. At 6, we'll hear Labor Radio. At 6:30, Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 59 degrees. Tomorrow's will be cloudy with occasional rain showers and a high of 69. Today in history, in 1957, tennis player Althea Gibson becomes the first African-American to win Wimbledon. Gibson again won Wimbledon as well as the U.S. Open in 1958. The quote of the day is from former First Lady Michelle Obama, who said, quote, "We've got a responsibility to live up to the legacy of those who came before us by doing all that we can to help those who come after us." This year's 4th of July had COVID-19, ongoing protests over systemic racism, and a presidential visit to Mount Rushmore. Plus, Trump signed an order to create a new state park. With more on those stories, it's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
Let us not forget the challenge that Douglas, a AME Zion, a Black Methodist, raised for us on this 4th of July weekend. And for us in our context, what to the Black New Jerseyan is the 4th of July?
This holiday, the Reverend Dr. Charles Boyer was one of many referencing the famous question that previously enslaved abolitionist Frederick Douglass posed on July 5th, 1852. What to the American slave is your 4th of July? Salvation and Social Justice, the nonpartisan Black faith-based organization Boyer founded, held a town hall to discuss how it resonates today in the context of healthcare, education, and economic justice.
Freedom ain't free, and we sure enough ain't free yet, especially here in New Jersey.
New Jersey has primary elections tomorrow, along with Delaware, both states delayed because of COVID-19. Reverend Dr. Weldon McWilliams is a pastor from Paterson, New Jersey.
I don't understand why in this country, right, that, you know, supposedly, and I say supposedly in quotations, supposedly wants people to vote, why does it have to be so difficult then?
McWilliams says elected officials need to get creative.
If we make it easier, I believe we'll see those numbers go up. But we have to also keep in mind, we have some folks who are invested in making sure that the voting rolls are limited and small, and certain people only get to vote while other people don't.
15 demonstrators were arrested at a protest before President Trump's Mount Rushmore event, held despite objections from local tribes. After a deeply divisive speech saying today's anti-racism protesters want to, quote, end America, unquote, Trump issued an executive order to plan a new statue garden with 31 American historical figures, notable conservatives high on the list. Former Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, Ronald Reagan, and evangelist Billy Graham are included, plus Abraham Lincoln and Martin Luther King Jr. Reporter Anthony Zurcher from BBC North America has been covering the Trump administration in 2020 elections.
I think it's a message to his supporters about who he values and who he thinks America should value.
Trump trails former Vice President Joe Biden, not only in public opinion polls, but even in internal Republican polls, it's been reported. Parties tend to release good polls when they have them. Republicans were releasing more internal polls pre-pandemic than Democrats, but in the last few months, it's switched. David Frum, author of Trumpocalypse, Restoring American Democracy, says economic signals also look bad for Trump. For one thing, the highest unemployment rate that didn't cost the then-president a re-election was 7.7% under Barack Obama.
And he had a reasonably narrow re-election. But he got through because in the 12 months before his re-election, job growth had been strong enough that the unemployment rate was heading steadily downward.
Frum says job growth isn't everything, but it's a telling indicator.
The Trump people keep insisting that everything's looking great. I have to think, it looks terrible.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
A federal judge rules that the Dakota Access Pipeline must be shut down. A legal defense fund is announced after arrests at Mount Rushmore, and Native groups respond to the Washington football team name review. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Dakota Access Pipeline must be shut down and drained of oil by August 5th. That order was handed down by a federal judge Monday. Judge James Boasberg had ruled earlier this year the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers violated the National Environmental Policy Act when it granted an easement to construct the pipeline under Lake Oahe. Boasberg says the Corps failed to produce an environmental impact statement even though the project required one. In March, he directed the Corps to complete the statement and took briefs on what the remedy should be in the meantime. Monday, Boasberg ruled the permit should be vacated until the Corps can complete the environmental study, which the Corps says will take 13 months. A grassroots movement drew international attention to tribal opposition of the pipeline as people from around the world camped near the Standing Rock Reservation in 2016 seeking to stop construction. The Rapid City, South Dakota-based group Indian Collective announced the Black Hills Bail and Legal Defense Fund over the weekend after an action near Mount Rushmore by Indigenous people and their allies led to arrests. According to Indian Collective, about a dozen people were arrested Friday blocking a road to Mount Rushmore leading up to President Trump's visit to the area. In a live stream by Indian Collective, men and women are seen holding a line blocking the road as police and riot gear move in. President and CEO of Indian Collective, Nick Tilson, was among those arrested. A rally was held over the weekend outside Pennington County Jail seeking his release. The group is calling for the closure of Mount Rushmore and for the Black Hills to be returned to Lakota people. Indigenous people marked Canada Day last week with counter demonstrations. Dan Karpinchuk has more.
Led by the Indigenous rights group Idle No More, Native people marked the day as a day of mourning with peace marches aimed at throwing a spotlight on the injustices they say they experienced in their communities. The Cancel Canada Day protests were meant to honor Indigenous, Black, migrant, women, and trans people who have died. And in a statement, the organization said it could not celebrate the ongoing genocide within Canada against Indigenous people. About 200 demonstrators gathered in downtown Vancouver. A peaceful vigil was held in Hamilton, Ontario, and a few dozen held rallies in Saskatoon, Halifax, and Fredericton. Perry Bellegarde is the National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations. Bellegarde says everyone must remain hopeful that they can build a better country together.
There is systemic racism and systemic discrimination in all systems, whether it be the healthcare system, the justice system, the educational system. But in order to deal with that, you have to acknowledge that it exists and then start working together to fix it. It's not acceptable in 2020. It's not acceptable at all in any year. And so we have a lot of work to do to go beyond that now. And I think there's a huge opportunity, but we have to do this together.
This year's Canada Day comes amidst anger over police brutality against Indigenous people, protests against pipelines, and accusations of systemic racism against Indigenous people. And many critics say celebrations of holidays such as Canada Day are celebrations of the symbols of colonialism. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
The National Congress of American Indians welcomed Friday's announcement by the Washington football team that it would conduct a thorough review of the team's R-word name. In a statement, NCAI said it's committed to addressing the name change. Other indigenous advocacy groups are expressing caution, including Arizona to rally against Native mascots. In a statement, AZ Rally questioned the motives behind the NFL team's announcement due to pressure from its financial sponsors. The statement said team owner Dan Snyder has ignored calls to change the name by individual Native people, Native organizations, and litigation. The team's announcement comes as racial justice events are being held across the country. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Iowa cities and towns are investing in renewable energy, but global warming may not be the main motivation. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Many cities and towns are investing in renewable energy, and climate change is not the only motivation. Carrie Carney is the executive director of 1,000 Friends of Iowa. The nonprofit encourages responsible land use and sustainability in cities and towns across the state.
A lot of the communities that have been taking action are really doing it for other reasons. Economic reasons being a big part of it, wanting to have more control over utility systems and so forth.
For example, the small city of Bloomfield, Iowa, has been looking to renewable energy as a way to help build the local economy.
As a jobs program, as a way to really help their low-income residents. So they set a goal basically of 100% energy independence.
To meet this 2030 goal, the municipal utility began installing solar, and the city is investing in energy efficiency. For example, it's offering energy audits for low-income residents and helping finance efficiency upgrades that residents gradually pay off through their utility bills. So Carney says cities and towns can help reduce carbon pollution, even if global warming is not their main reason for doing so. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Visitors can now experience popular parks and attractions virtually as an adaptation to the constraints of the COVID-19 pandemic. Tramell Gomes has more on the story with the Public News Service.
While the coronavirus pandemic has altered many travel plans, many attractions are offering an interactive virtual experience in the era of social distancing. Some popular theme parks are providing virtual rides. You can even gaze at sea creatures at aquariums online or become an at-home park visitor at national and state parks across the country. Ellen Leroy Reed with the Friends of GTM Reserve or the Guanatelamato Matanzas Research Reserve says they used to get about 300,000 visitors each year to their site near Jacksonville. And before the pandemic, she is thankful they were able to launch a virtual program for students unable to travel.
When we found out that we were shutting down, we realized this is a wonderful opportunity for us to take the VR program that we typically bring to students with the headsets and put it onto our website and share it through email or set up webinars with students.
Visitors now can experience the world of estuaries from the comforts of their homes through virtual reality with science lessons that meet state educational standards. Leroy Reed says the VR experience is more immersive, with pop-ups visitors might otherwise miss when trekking along on the vast more than 76,000-acre reserve.
You can learn what to look for when you can come out and tour these spaces and learn about research projects that are happening that you would otherwise not have noticed, or you can learn about a specific plant or animal that is vital to that particular ecosystem.
Some parts of the reserve sites, which stretch from Pontevedra to Palm Coast, still are open for hiking, canoeing, and wildlife observation. These federally protected sites are possible through the Coastal Zone Management Act, which Congress passed in 1972 to help states conserve waters and coastal habitats. The educational programs at GTM are now available online for students up to fifth grade, but content will soon expand for students through 12th grade. Support for this reporting was provided by the Pew Charitable Trusts. For Public News Service, I'm Tramell Gomes.
Thank you. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, July 6th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Jeffrey Wade. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Antonia Gonzalez, Eric Galatis, Roz Brown, Tramel Gomes, and Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 8, it's the Abe and Joe Talk radio show, covering politics, history, and the state of the zeitgeist. At 9, alternative radio features lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, it's Stage and Studio. Host Dime Roberts presents the episode Ni Nika Ni Gringa from the series Legacies, Tales from America. Then at 11:30, Art Focus host Joseph Gallivan interviews Portland painter Sherry Wolf about her new show, Memento. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our listeners. If you'd like to support our programming, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for a special broadcast of Making Contact, featuring law professor Kimberly Crenshaw, who helped to first define intersectionality 30 years ago.
You're listening to Making Contact.
This is Making Contact. I'm your guest host, Paulina Velasco. When you look at the way the coronavirus pandemic is playing out in the United States, the people that are dying, the people that are out of work, and those who are fed up and taking to the streets to protest a racist system, to say Black Lives Matter, how is it all connected?
There was the moment of, oh my God, there is a racial crisis here. Oh my goodness, this is actually playing out in devastating ways in its impact on African-American, Latinx communities, Native communities. So who knew? Well, actually, a lot of people knew, right?
That's Kimberly Crenshaw. She's a law professor at UCLA and Columbia Law Schools, and the co-founder and executive director of the African American Policy Forum. Crenshaw developed the theory of intersectionality 30 years ago. Intersectionality refers to how multiple forms of discrimination, like for example based on your race, gender, or class, can overlap or intersect in your experience of the world and how you're treated. Like, for example, a Black woman is discriminated against not solely for being Black and not solely for being a woman, but for the intersection of those two identities. Crenshaw's framework allows us to see that there's a compounding, an intersection of problems, and it's a useful tool to look at our current crises. Kimberly Crenshaw spoke about the need for intersectionality in an interview with Janine Jackson, hosted by Haymarket Books and the African American Policy Forum on May 5th, 2020. She says many people made the mistake of discarding intersectionality when the COVID crisis set in.
At the time, the conversation was still in the well, this may be the one thing that brings everybody to the table to recognize the need for universal health care. This will be the one moment that we have been theorizing will happen that will cause people to give up their fantasies about whiteness, maleness, whatever, and they'll recognize that we're all just one race, the human race, and we need to pull all together. So there was this sense that this is the moment that shows that all quote unquote identity-oriented politics that are not human identity politics are yesterday's news, and they don't do us any good. And so I was pretty much clear that this was just going to be another moment where human crises would not create the moment of recognition of our common humanity, and that that crisis was actually going to reinforce the pre-existing structured and historical vulnerabilities that we've been trying to use intersectionality to talk about, you know, for a generation. Now we do have these outcomes that suggest that we're not all in this together. You know, COVID may be an equal opportunity lethal force, but it doesn't impact us in an equal way. How now do we talk about these differences? And that's when we saw, I think, the consequences of over a decade of post-racial, non-racial, colorblind discourse. So if you don't have a robust framework that is attending to structured institutional forms of power, if you don't have a structural racism framework and you're looking at difference, you take power out of the equation, all you have is difference. And the difference is embodied in the people who are being differently impacted. So that's why we get a Surgeon General who comes on and uses racialized, racially coded talk to basically say, you have control over this. You have to start acting differently. So the disease is actually projected into bodies, into communities, into culture. That's the consequence of not having an analysis that, number one, is attending to pre-existing inequalities, and number two, that understands that you can have a dynamic, which is COVID, which itself may be, you know, obviously a blind to social difference, but it intersects with pre-existing social differences that produce these outcomes. So one of the things that, you know, sort of a go-to point that I make with respect to the importance of an intersectional prism is that if you really don't have the language to see a problem, you can't really fix it. And the primary example of that is that the language that we currently have that's mainstream is an understanding of inequality as being unjust only if it's produced by some decision maker whose absolute intent, reason for doing the thing they're doing, is because of bigotry, hatred, or at minimum, complete and utter disdain for a particular group. Where does that idea come from? Part of that idea comes from sort of the history of how certain disciplines have conceptualized what discrimination is, what it is constituted by. Within the American Academy, the idea that, you know, discrimination and illegitimate power should be thought about as structural as opposed to a feature of psychology was fought about and lost in the 50s, right? There were earlier ways of thinking about inequality as a societal problem that looked at its sociology and its structure as opposed to its psychology and its individual, you know, sort of personality-driven contours. But that got lost. And part of the consequence of that loss is that when law finally started to pay attention to discrimination, it had readily available to it, after a very short period of debate, a very narrow conception of what constitutes illegitimate inequality. And that basically became the moment when the law adopted that in a case called Washington versus Davis. The only thing that really counts as illegitimate inequality as far as the Constitution is concerned is when an actor decides to go after people simply because of who they are. Well, that's a very small subset of all the ways that illegitimate power plays out across race, gender, and other groups. But making that move means that constitutional law became increasingly less useful to dismantle white supremacy, to dismantle the illegitimate expectations that many white voters had in the status quo staying exactly the way it was. And then that gets doubled down by the fact that the right figured out pretty early that a key place where they could draw the line in the sand and protect their interests was the courts. So now the courts are completely on board. The consequences of these decisions we're going to see in the future when lawsuits start coming up, not only with respect to the groups that are completely shut out of the remedies to the economic downturn, but there are going to be lawsuits about opening up these economies knowing that people are going to die. There are going to be lawsuits about, you know, not being able to work because of suspicion that you might be infected. There are going to be all sorts of lawsuits. And largely, many of these lawsuits are going to go into court with judges that have been appointed by the Federalist Society during a time where the right was clear about the need to take over the courts. So it's, again, another moment where I think it's important to be able to fully understand the different dimensions of empowerment.
You're listening to Kimberly Crenshaw speaking about how the framework of intersectionality can help us understand the coronavirus pandemic's unequal impacts. But she says this useful tool is often misunderstood and manipulated.
30 years later, intersectionality has now been framed as all sorts of things, but the most interesting part of it to me is the way that it's been picked up as sort of a battering ram, you know, by the right to accuse progressives of identity politics. And what I find fascinating about that is that the main claim made by what I call the anti-intersectionalists is a grievance claim that itself is a product of identity politics. So, you know, Lindsey Graham, for example, in that moment during the Kavanaugh hearings that some of us still have post-traumatic stress around, there's a moment where he gave voice to this intersectionality when he says, you know, I'm a straight white man and I know that I'm supposed to shut up, you know, but I'm not going to shut up. And he goes on, you know, with this, grievance. We are, you know, being oppressed by, you know, all of these various groups that all come together under the intersectional frame. It's clear from that moment that the complaint against intersectionality is not that it's about the intersections of identity. It's clearly not about, structured inequalities. It's just about the people that they see riding in this vehicle and the politics that come with those people and the histories that come with those politics. That's what much of the critique of intersectionality is all about. Instead, it's important to see intersectionality as a prism for helping us see and predict and interact with the pre-existing structures that intersectionality can help us see and that COVID has laid bare. One hears echoes of some of the same inpatient distancing from intersectional sensibilities within our quarters as one hears on the right. And I've seen that. I've seen it written, like, this is the post-intersectional moment. What the heck does that mean? When we can look across at this moment and see, you know, essential yet expendable, you know, worker reflects the same convergence of vulnerable identities now that as it did, you know, decades ago. What does it mean to say we're post-intersectional when we can look at, we've called them geographies of confinement, and see that the risk of COVID is dramatically increased for those populations who live at the intersections of lots of things. Let's look at, you know, how markets situate some workers, both in terms of our own national market, but globally, as people who are essential but actually have no real home. We look at the intersections and confinement within a community. So if we look at food deserts, if we look at places where one has to drive for 100 miles to get to a hospital, as we learned in Indian country, that's intersections of settler colonialism, of class, of just political marginality. We can continue to name all of these places where the morbidity tracks onto being confined both physically but also politically by the forces of white supremacy, by the forces of patriarchy, and so on. I don't know how you look at that stuff and say we're post-intersectional. I literally do not know what people are talking about when they say that. I think the most perhaps kind of unusual aspect of that was when we did geographies of confinement and talked about the clusters of death that are happening in prisons and in ICE facilities and what's happening in nursing homes. The tendency is to see what's happening in nursing homes and what's happening in prisons as sort of mutually exclusive. The populations is mutually exclusive. The justifications for what is happening to them as mutually exclusive. But if you actually start looking more closely, you see in both of these populations, there are people who have largely been written off, either because of some projection of choice, they did things that put them in that situation, or inevitability. They are just older people, and older people are subject to COVID. And what's less seen is that these are these death facilities are the product of choices. They're product of choices of using the carceral state as a mechanism of social ordering and disciplinary social ordering on top of that. Choices about now that has been an investment, not to practice humanitarian release and let people go. Their choices about warehousing older people and doing so with a profit motivation that ensures that, you know, 90% of people in nursing homes are going to have some experience of neglect. And that's across class. And then finally, there are those commonality of interest between those who have to work in those facilities and those who have to live in them. So partly because of the profit motivation, workers who work in these facilities often cannot sustain their lives on those wages, which means that they move from one facility to another. They have multiple responsibilities. It makes them vulnerable. It makes the people that they are caring for vulnerable. It makes their, you know, families vulnerable. So all of these are moments where when we start talking about confinement, then we, you know, talk more broadly about what's happening in the home, what's happening in native country, what's happening in formally segregated communities. We are able to see where intersectional commonalities exist and hopefully come up with ways of expecting something different in the aftermath. We don't want to go back to normal. Normal was messed up. We were doing a webinar a couple of weeks ago when we were introducing the idea of disaster white supremacy, building off of the great Naomi Klein's work about disaster capitalism, and you know, directly interrogating the ways that disasters present opportunities for white supremacist projects that may have not been fully expressed or articulated, or may have had to be produced in ways in which the supremacist dimensions were suppressed or hidden behind, you know, frameworks of, you know, the losses of middle America or rural America, where whiteness is not expressly part of it. But in the disaster moment, those shackles come off, and one gets the full Monty, as it were. So we want to talk about how emergencies, how moments of anxiety, moments of economic and political instability are not necessarily moments where we all come together. Historically in the United States, there have been moments where we fall apart. After all, we had a civil war. And we've had many smaller versions of these wars since then. So I think COVID is, again, an opportunistic disease that facilitates the converging of many right-wing flavors of politics. They are able to elevate whiteness as its ideological expression, elevating whiteness as it has been expressed across, you know, the centuries here, and do so in a way that normalizes stuff that, you know, Trump began to normalize by saying, oh, they're nice people, you know, on both sides, to, oh, those are nice people taking taking guns to the Capitol. The governor should sit down with them. This normalization is an incredible danger, and we've got to stop seeing it as just fringe politics. We've got to see it as potentially the politics of the future.
That's Professor Kimberly Crenshaw, and you're listening to Making Contact and RadioProject.org. What are your thoughts on intersectionality, COVID-19, Black Lives Matter? Give us a call at 510-239-3899. That's 510-239-3899. Or join the conversation on social media. On Twitter, we're at making_contact. Kimberly Crenshaw appeared on Haymarket Books' forum on intersectionality and COVID before the U.S. erupted in protests against police murders of Black people. Those protests were followed by increased police brutality and state violence. Much like Crenshaw predicted, white supremacy reared its head. Soon after, Crenshaw went on Pacifica's show, Letters in Politics, on June 1st, 2020, to talk to host Mitch Jezerich about how intersectionality is key to understanding this moment as well.
Well, I'm thinking about many different aspects of, I guess, a common theme, and that would be the precarity of Black life in the United States. We are now in the moment in which many people are grieving, having seen an African-American man being killed deliberately, it seems, his suffering not being heard, his pleas for his life being disregarded, officers seemingly taking this as just another day at the office, snuffing out another life. The inhumanity of it, I think, is shocking to so many people. And at the same time, I struggle to hold unfathomable dimension of this man's life being taken, along with the thousands of people who are dying every day from decisions that have been made to prioritize the economy, to prioritize the comfort, to prioritize the preferences and the privileges of some over the lives and the well-being of others. And holding these together at the same time is, you know, in some ways, an act of jujitsu. You have to be responsive to the emergency that happens, and you have to also see the emergency that's always been there that this is built on top of. We are shocked when we see elements of American life that seem to be ripped from the pages of history. We're seeing, frankly, lynchings happening now, you know, too many. There shouldn't be any, but to see them happening again is shocking. Let's think about what makes this possible, right? Police departments across the country spend millions of dollars every year in settling cases like these. The police officers involved, although these were fired, are often free to go somewhere else and actually become a police officer. So, for example, the police officer that killed Tamir Rice, he was the little boy who was killed in Cleveland when a police officer rolled up on him and got out of the car and shot him because he was reported as having a gun, turned out to be a toy gun. He had been dismissed from another police department as unfit for service. Many police officers are able to go somewhere else. Why? A, there's no registry. There is no mechanism that is fully enforceable across all police departments that makes it clear that if you have been fired because of abuse of your authority, because you have killed people, because you are untrainable, because you are unfit, there's nothing that prevents them, if the police departments themselves don't commit to it, to hiring them. Why is that? Well, one of the most powerful unions we have is the police union. And part of their power is because they are able to convince the majority of Americans, we are the ones that are protecting you. If our ability to do what we have to do in order to protect you is constrained in ways that make it tougher for us to do our job, then law and order is going to suffer. You are going to suffer. So these are just some of the ways that we have to begin unpacking what are the conditions of possibility that allow this problem to go on uninterrupted. That's something that we can change. We can change that by making these issues politically costly for mayors, for elected officials. If there are unjustified killings like this, you are going to suffer at the polls. And then we've got to put our political resources in the middle of that and say, not in our name will we allow you to continue killing people and otherwise abusing them, saying that you are promoting law and order. This is law and disorder. This is law and inequality. And we refuse to allow you to use us as the justification for it. That can be done. There just hasn't been political will as yet to make that happen. It is important to recognize that police violence and vigilante violence, which happened to Ahmaud Arbery, are all a piece of the precarity of Black life. There is violence that happens both public and private, and it's both historical violence and contemporary violence, all an expression of the fact that Black life has largely been seen as expendable, essential, but expendable. That's been the basic logic of our presence here since we arrived on these shores. Absolutely essential to building the country, and the terms of our presence have always been one in which Black life has taken a back seat to property, to markets, to home values, to professions, and now
you know, to the comfort and security of people who want to go back to getting their hair cut and getting their nails done and going to restaurants. That's a logic that is pretty much like a slave logic. It's you exist for us. We don't exist for you, so we don't have to do anything to protect your life. I think it's important to draw the line between the killing on the street that happened to George Floyd, the killing in the home that happened to Breonna Taylor, the threat of calling the police that we saw in Central Park, and the broader, huger, you know, decision to go back to work, knowing that the disproportionate impact of that is going to be on particular lives. Question is, if it were the other way around, what would we be looking at? That I think really is, you know, the moment in which we have to think about how race may be the condition of this possibility.
That was Kimberly Crenshaw on Letters in Politics with host Mitch Jezerich and produced by Diana Martinez. Janine Jackson hosted the conversation about intersectionality, convened by the African American Policy Forum and Haymarket Books. Special thanks to John McDonald. Professor Kimberly Crenshaw hosts a webinar called Under the Blacklight, the Intersectional Failures That COVID Lays Bare, and also has a podcast, Intersectionality Matters. We'll link to those at our site, radioproject.org. I'm Paulina Velasco. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
Portland.
Hello. Welcome to the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists segment of Labor Radio, highlighting the works of the working class, by the working class, and for the working class, here on KBOO 90.7.